in a stagflation or inflationary buzz, in fact, asset not to own is fixed income. So there are still a lot of flows to be redirected from bonds into other asset classes. I mean, I think that part of these flows, which are still invested in fixed income, will find their way in commodities, will find their way in gold, will find their way in silver. But we can also expect that part of these fixed income flows will find their ways in some kind of equities. So if we look back, and I like to look at history, so if we look back around the 1970s, where we had a very significant inflation, in fact, some sectors did very well in this stagflation. So we can think that, for example, energy companies will do very well, especially if this stagflation is driven by much higher oil price.
Laurent, the macro butler, how are you today?
Well, thank you, Andy. It's my pleasure to be back on your show.
Thanks for coming on. I do really appreciate it. What I really like about you, you are out of Southeast Asia, correct me if I'm wrong, oh, Thailand. And I like that you have an international view, really, of what's going on in the world, or a different view, if you would, from an international perspective, what's going on here in the U.S. Let's start with what's your thoughts on what's going to happen for the second half here. Start with the U.S. economy, and then let's work our way out to the world economy here. What's your thoughts and impressions here?
Well, I try to connect all the dots. And in today's world, I think that it's very important to have a global view. So, I mean, for the time being, the U.S. economy is still in an inflationary boom. But clearly, over the past few months, we have seen the U.S. economy weakening. And I think that what's coming next, and how quickly the U.S. could move from this inflationary boom into an inflationary bust, depends on the evolution of the geopolitical situation, and so clearly depends of what kind of action President Trump will really take against Russia and against the BRICS over the next few days and weeks, as this clearly could impact the oil price, many commodity prices. This could push the U.S. economy, like the rest of the world, into a stagflation that at the end of the day would probably be remembered as the Trump stagflation.
Yeah. So do you expect a significant drop in equity prices moving into the second half of the year because of all of the really the inflationary pressures that we've had. But then you mentioned that you could see an inflationary bust that would indicate a significant drop in asset prices. What are your thoughts on that? Work that out for me.
Well, I think that it depends on what type of equities we are talking about. I think if we are looking at index level, we are probably heading into a much higher volatility environment. We are probably also heading into an environment where many equities, which have still outperformed since the start of the year, start to underperform. But I would say that I wouldn't say that I'm very negative on the equity market in general for two reasons. First, I mean, in a stagflation or inflationary buzz, in fact, asset not to own is fixed income. So there are still a lot of flows to be redirected from bonds into other asset classes. I mean, I think that part of these flows, which are still invested in fixed income, will find their way in commodities, will find their way in gold, will find their way in silver. But we can also expect that part of these fixed income flows will find their ways in some kind of equities. So if we look back, and I like to look at history, so if we look back around the 1970s, where we had a very significant inflation, in fact, some sectors did very well in this inflation. So we can think that, for example, energy companies will do very well, especially if this inflation is driven by much higher oil price. We can also think that every company that are related to hard assets, meaning all type of commodities, will also probably do very well. Because I think that, in fact, this stagflation could find its origin in an eating up of the war cycle. And of course, we all know that across centuries, wars have been driving to shortages, and especially commodity shortages. So, I mean, I think that, yes, we will see volatility in equities. Probably you will see the Nasdaq underperforming other indices. Probably you could see a significant drawdown in the S&P 500, because most of the S&P 500 is still indexed to IT and other energy consumers. But I would think that, in fact, the energy producer, the commodity producer will do very well in this environment. So I think that the second half of the year will be a period of time where investors will do much more hard work in terms of stock picking than they have done since the start of the year.
So you mentioned several times there about energy, and it sounds like you're very optimistic about energy prices, if you would go, or bullish energy prices. Work that out for me. Why do you sound bullish on energy, and why do you see a potential rise in energy prices, specifically oil?
Well, I'm not bullish in terms of demand. I think that demand for energy products and oil will be lackluster over the next 6 to 12 months, because the economy probably will keep slowing down. But I'm very bullish on the supply side. I think that if we see an escalation of the war in Eastern Europe, especially with Russia, if we see an escalation of the war once again in the Middle East, as we saw during the month of June, if sanctions are put on Russian oil, I think that this will impact oil supply. And yes, OPEC can still provide some spare capacities to deliver more supply. But at the end of the day, OPEC has done very few capex over the past few years. The U.S. oil and gas companies are not really drilling. We have not seen yet any sign of a drill baby. If you look at the results of the Schlumberger, Halliburton of this world, they don't tell their shareholders that they have seen an improve in businesses. So, I mean, there's no drill baby drill in the U.S. CapEx have been constrained among OPEC members. So I think that any impact on oil supply will have a big impact on the price. And I think that I wouldn't rule out to see $100 WTI by the end of the year, in fact.
Wow. Yeah, that would be a significant rise. Wow. Interesting. Talk to me about precious metals here. Gold ripped the first half of the year. It's consolidated really the last 2 to 3 months, or I would really say since maybe April. But it looks like, and it's in a range right now, it looks like silver is starting to catch up, if you would. What's your expectation for both gold, silver, precious metals going into the second half of the year?
Well, I think that if we see this reallocation of flows from fixed income into precious metal, and here I just give you an example. The total AUM of all the global bond market is around $300 trillion US dollar. The total value of all the gold mine at the end of last year is around $22 trillion a US dollar. So if only 10% of flows move from the fixed income into the gold, which I think is very possible in the world that we are in, I mean, this would easily mean that the gold price could still double from here. So I think that we have seen the gold price have been mostly driven by central bank buying, mostly in the BRICS countries and in emerging markets, because these countries have understood that owning a US dollar asset and any kind of US dollar asset can be dangerous for them, since Russian assets have been frozen. So clearly, this trend is not broken. In fact, would President Trump take further sanction against the BRICS, this would accelerate a trend that have started since February 2022. So I think that for the gold price, I'm not too worried. I mean, I've seen this before, the gold price move in stay. So they've been sideways since April, slightly down. But I would think that the reason why gold is at the current price and why gold should move much higher are still intact. Regarding silver, I would say it's much more speculative. We have started to see Russian central bank building silver strategic reserve. So this is something new. I mean, no other central bank so far has started to buy silver. Silver has been really lagging the bull market in gold. And the reason is that, as I said, most of the bull market in gold is being driven by central bank buy. I would think that silver will probably catch up. I personally think that, and for my clients, what I recommend is an allocation around 30 to 40% of their asset in physical gold, and an allocation around 10 to 15% in physical silver. I mean, it depends all of the risk appetite of the clients and the ability of the client to stomach volatility.
Got it. Okay. So talk to me a little bit about the equities here. Would you, do you like the miners, the equities, if you would?
Well, I think that in general, I would think that the market, the equity market is mature for a pullback. So I won't rule out a 10 to 15% pullback in major indices. But as I said, this would be a very good opportunity for investors to look at companies that will do well in this upcoming inflationary bust. So, I mean, the miners are ticking a lot of boxes. As I said, I think that this inflationary bust most probably be triggered by an escalation of the geopolitical tension. And of course, this will mean that supply of a lot of commodities could be constrained by the wars. And also, in fact, most of the miners, especially the big companies in the industry, have put their balance sheet into order. So I also like all companies that have very little debt or no debt, that are able to deliver recurring free cash flow. And I think what is important in the upcoming environment is to look at these companies which will be able to continue to grow their free cash flow with the upcoming bust that we are going to face. So the miners are part of the allocation. I would also look at some industrial companies. I think that the U.S. is in a big need of more infrastructure spending. If really President Trump is committed to make America great again, it needs to make American infrastructure great again as well. So I would think that a lot of U.S. industrial companies will benefit from this. And on the side, as I said, all companies, all producers are very attractively priced in the current environment. And I want to highlight what investor I think should avoid to own. And outside, I mean the Magnificent Seven, which are widely owned and which are widely exposed to any changes in big indices. I would think that investors should stay away of everything that is related to the consumer, especially everything that is consumer discretionary related, because I mean at the end of the day, a tariff is a tax. Someone has to pay this tax. It seems by now that the tax will be or is mostly paid by the consumer. And on the other hand, we don't really see any wage growth. So clearly, it's difficult to see how a consumer discretionary stock will do well in this environment.
Yeah, I would agree just about with everything you said. In our portfolio, oils actually our biggest allocation, oil equities, just because of the fair where we see the value, if you would. And what, as you said, we like to see producers, and they can even be small producers or early stage producers, but we want to see free cash flow coming in on a monthly or quarterly, a great on a monthly basis, really. Talk to me a little bit about base metals, critical minerals, if you would. Copper had such a strong run, and then we've had a correction. I was in at a conference in Florida, and I actually sat with Frank Ustra and asked him what his number one commodity he would be invested in over the next few to several years. I don't know about right now, but he said nickel. What are your thoughts on base and critical metals and minerals going into the next few years, and how would you invest in them?
Well, I would quite agree about nickel. In fact, nickel is a very important base metal used in weapon and aerospace defense. So if we think that we are heading into an environment that is much more turmoil in terms of geopolitical situation, I think nickel will do very well. I would think that mostly all base metal will do quite well in the current environment. I mean, the problem that the US have is still that it's lacking potential growth in terms of new mining development. I mean, it's quite understandable because during the previous administration, very few mining projects were started, very few mining companies decided to start mining in the US per se, because of the ESG constraint, because all the DEI constraint. And clearly, it takes a long time to develop a mining project. So it takes at least between 3 to 5 years to see the first production. At sometimes it's even longer than 5 years. So even that, if the current administration comes to kind of stimulate domestic supply in the US of base metal, it will clearly take at least until the end of this administration to see the first results. So I mean, I think that in fact this is the point of one of the point of weakness of the US in the current escalation of geopolitics is that a lot of these base metal are mostly located in BRICS countries, and like Brazil, Indonesia, for nickel. Russia, of course, is the largest base metal producer in the world. So I mean, going into war with countries which have massive production and reserve of base metal, while domestically the US is kind of lacking this kind of reserve and production. Not because it's not blessed, don't get me wrong. I think the US is blessed with a lot of resources. It's just that the previous administration We have more focus on developing internet platform app for mobile rather than the mines. So, I mean, I would think that we will see much higher prices for many commodities in the coming quarters and years. And I would think that there are a lot of opportunities in this sector. But I would recommend investors, especially those who have little risk appetite, to focus on the mining giant, because the good things of the giant, the big miners, and here I just give some like Rio Tinto or Freeport McMoRan, is that they have a very steady balance sheet. So in fact, they have the ability to acquire the smaller player, which remains very speculative.
Yeah, got it. So what do you expect now, and all of that, and thank you for your recommendations, or I shouldn't say recommendations, everybody do their own due diligence. But what is your expectation here going forward through the end of the year with central banks and interest rates here, just in a global perspective? Because it seems like they're really pushed into a corner with a slowing economy, yet higher inflationary pressures. What's your expectation? Do you expect easing going into the second half of the year?
Well, it depends on which central bank we are talking about. If we are talking about the Fed, to be honest, I don't expect any Fed rate cut before the end of the year. I think that third between Powell and Trump is kind of a sideshow. The real impact for the U.S. economy is from the 10-year and the 30-year yield. So, in fact, the Fed could keep easily the Fed's fund rate change and come back potentially with a kind of QE to keep the 10-year and the 30-year yield under control. And in fact, there's something already brewing behind the curtain, because U.S. dollar liquidity has started to increase again, and meaning that behind the curtain, even if Fed is still doing QT, in fact, there are a lot of U.S. dollar liquidity coming back into the system via the TGA, the reverse repo, and other mechanism that the Fed can use. So I don't think that the Fed will do anything. I think that, in fact, and I wrote about this last week, I think that by pushing Jerome Powell to cut rates, Donald Trump is doing a mistake. I think that if we look at what happened in the past in emerging markets, once the political system pressure the central bank, in fact, is the start of a lot of trouble, is usually inflationary, because it means that the independence of the central bank is not guaranteed. And in fact, it's a step of the U.S. to turn into a kind of a banana republic. Or, I mean, if we look at past history, I mean, we all know that the president of Turkey, Erdogan, has fired many central bankers in Turkey, and it didn't end well for the Turkish currency. It didn't end well for the Turkish inflation, because all this pressure from the political power on a central bank, in fact, increased the distrust that investor and also citizen have in their country. And we all know that one major source of inflation at the end of the day is the lack of trust of investor and the lack of trust of citizen in their public institution. So I don't think that the U.S. should go down that path. I think it's a big mistake. If I look at the other big economies, Europe has been, the Eurozone has been cutting rates quite aggressively since the start of the year. I think that the ECB is mostly done, even if you never know what Lagarde could do. I think that the situation in Europe, the economy landscape in Europe is very dire. And of course, we could see probably at the end of the day, the ECB back with whatever it takes to save the banking system, to save the governments that are all heading, especially European governments are heading into a sovereign default, which I expect to happen next year or in 2027. And if we look at Japan, in fact, Japan needs a really a rate hike. Japan has been under inflation pressure over the past few months. And I think that even if a rate hike will not really solve the problem, because most of the inflation in Japan is driven by food prices, especially rice prices. So I think that the Bank of Japan is also turning quite irrelevant and shows that, in fact, the central bank cannot control everything. And then finally, I will end in China. So China has been cutting rates quite aggressively. I mean, Chinese economy is also in a lackluster kind of environment. But I would say that the Chinese are trying to exit their own problem with time. And I mean, we could see the PBOC cut a little bit further and inject further liquidity to kind of sustain the economy. But I would think that China, I mean, we could discuss about China for an hour, but I would think that China, in fact, is doing the right thing, is trying to reduce its overcapacity, is developing a new trade relationship with the BRICS, with Southeast Asia, with the One Belt, One Road initiative. And China is slowly moving out of its real estate bubble into a consumer economy, into an economy that will trade mostly with other emerging markets. So I think that here the PBOC will look to build credibility because from my point of view, I think that the PBOC understand that the only alternative to the US dollar in post-de-dollarized world is the yuan. Not that I think that the PBOC want the yuan to become the new reserve currency of the world, but I think that they want to attract investor and especially bond investor over the long term. So they will probably keep a very, I would say, drastic policy, but still easing when it's needed. So, I mean, it has been a long answer to a short question, but I think that the situation is quite different. But to summarize, I would think that in most of the cases, the central banks are becoming irrelevant in a way that what is driving economic growth and what is driving inflation is mostly related to the escalation of the war cycle and also to issues of shortages and rising food prices. So, I mean, if we are going into an environment where commodity prices are rising because of shortages, if we are seeing higher food prices coming on the horizon, I think that whatever central banks are doing is quite of irrelevant, because cutting rates or raising rates will not really impact, resolve this issue of shortages.
Got it. Okay, so there is a lot there. Then I would like to push on, or like to pull this out. China, you mentioned China. You were actually agreeing with what they're currently doing. China's been in a mess the last few years. Do you think they're bottoming, and would you allocate money to them, if you would, and work that out for a little bit for me? And then you also mentioned central banks becoming irrelevant, if you would, or extinct, if you would. If we don't have central banks, and I'm all for that, by the way, I don't think we should have central banks, but then, but if we don't, then what? So two different questions.
Well, around China, I mean, There are a lot to unpack around China. I will summarize it in very succinct sentences. I mean, China had a real estate problem. And the reason that China had a real estate problem is first, is demography. And second, is that I would say during the first mandate of Donald Trump, the Chinese government understood that China will not be welcome to sell its goods to the US. So, what the Chinese government have done is that they have forced the Chinese bank to stop financing real estate, and they forced the Chinese bank to finance the industrial revolution of China. And that's why you have seen Xiaomi, Huawei, BYD emerging as global leaders. And to be honest, living in Southeast Asia and being able to compare Chinese product with American products, I can tell you that BYD is 10 times better than a Tesla and 10 times cheaper than a Tesla. That Huawei or Xiaomi phone is probably 3 times better than Apple phone, and also 3 times cheaper than Apple phone. So I mean, there's no secret. I mean, China is still the largest manufacturer in the world. The Chinese government decided to move the focus from real estate to industrialization and technology. So China developed AI. China is probably also ahead in terms of drone manufacturing. China is also probably ahead in many IT services. The thing is that most Americans don't really know what's happening in China because nothing is really related. Reported by the mass media about China. And when the American mass media talk about China, in fact, is to talk about the real estate crisis, is to talk about the problems that are old problems that everyone knows. So I would think that China is moving ahead and becoming, I would say, still ha being the largest manufacturer in the world. China has decided that so it cannot be a trade partner of the US because the US is not really a reliable partner anymore. And so China has focused on new trading partner, and the geopolitical event has kind of pushed China in the arms of Russia and India. And I mean, if you combine Russia, which has the largest supply of natural resources and the cheapest natural resources in the world. I mean, if they can supply these natural resources to China, and China can sell its goods to India, which is the largest consumer economy to be. In fact, the West has created what I call the triumvirate: Russia, China, India, which I think in the next decade cannot be beaten. I mean, it will be very difficult for the West to beat a combination of Russia, China, and India. So you ask me if US investors should invest in China. I would say no. I would think that for a US investor, investing in China is a geopolitical risk.
Right.
I think that coming in the next few quarters or years, what the US government did for people who invested in Russian equities or in Russian financial assets could easily happen to those investors who are investing in Chinese financial assets. If you sit in Asia, if you sit in Southeast Asia, and you own a trading account into a local broker, I think that, of course, you should start investing in China. But as I said, investing in China is not advisable for American and Western investors in general, because I think that we will see more sanctions against China. And at the end of the day, this war that has started, I mean, let's be honest, between the US and Russia, it's also a war against China. So as I said, I would, as a US investor, I wouldn't invest in China because there's too much risk in terms of the geopolitical connotation.
How about central banks?
Okay, so about central banks, I think that, I mean, the central banks have been developed on the idea of Canadian theory, meaning that the government can control everything. And to be honest, I'm not from this side of point of view. I think that everything is about cycle and everything is energy. So in fact, central banks are probably there at best to be a regulator of the financial system of their own country. Can they set a price for an interest rate? Yes, I mean, they put the price of the short-term rate. But as I said, look at the US, the short-term rate is not really relevant for the US economy. If you take a mortgage, if you take a car loan, what is important is the 30-year yield, it's not the Fed fund rate. So I think that central banks in general, clearly there, I would say, to regulate the financial system. They are there probably also to put some level of interest rates. I mean, we have seen, in fact, in the recent past, in recent history, central banks have been using their balance sheet to try to manipulate the bond market. But at the end of the day, I mean, they have been manipulating the bond market for a few years, and then the market has won. You can see if you invested $100 in a U.S. Treasury index at the start of this decade, it's worth $80 on the inflation adjusted. So, I mean, even that they are not able to preserve the wealth of investor in terms of bond investment. So I would think that, I mean, central banks, as I said, they are needed to regulate financial systems, probably in some countries. And here I would think that in countries like in Asia, they are probably much more powerful than in the West nowadays. And I think because the central banks of Southeast Asia, of the global South, have kind of learned their lesson of the financial crisis in 1998. And I mean, since the recovery that all these countries, emerging markets, what is still called emerging markets, but we are not really emerging anymore. In fact, the central banks at the first target is to not see the IMF again. So they manage, I would say, the economy very drastically, and they didn't want to see the IMF coming back, and they didn't want to see their economy to be under the threat of the Western world and the Western bank. I would remember here that I take the example of Thailand. I mean, in 1998, during the Asian financial crisis, all the big American banks, Goldman Sachs and others, were queuing to buy land in Thailand at 10 cents of the dollars. And I would think that, fortunately, for the Thai people, the government decided that foreigners would not be able allowed to buy land. As I said, the central banks in Southeast Asia, the global South, have been managing the economy for not having again to see the Goldman Sachs of this world being the predators of the asset. I think that they've learned their lesson of this Asian financial crisis. On the other hand, in the Western world, they didn't really learn any lesson. They've been reckless. They've sold their gold asset. They went even to negative interest rate in Japan and in Europe. So to be honest, I don't think that the central bank have even had any public service for the people for what they are supposed to do.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. Laurent, if people want to know more about you, find out more about you, read your work or do business with you, how do they find you?
Well, they can find me on Substack at The Macro Butler. If they want to ask any question or they want to be in touch with me, even I think that many people won't agree with my opinions, they can always send me an email at info@themacrobutler.com. I also help high net worth individuals to navigate these difficult times. And also, I just started a Telegram channel where I put some thought outside the Substack.
Excellent. I'll put all of this in the show notes, both on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Thank you so much, Laurent, the Macro Butler.
Thank you, Andy. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.